you stand, please?
Make sure you're alert.
Yes.
And we stand out of reverence because of God's word. When you go to a court, to a courtroom, as soon as the judge walks in, what do they say? All rise, right? Why? Out of reverence. The same thing. God's here through His word. He's speaking to us. So Ruth chapter 1, starting verse 1 through verse 5. In the days when the judges were judging, there was a famine in the land. And a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife, Naomi. And the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem in Judah. They went into the country of Moab and remained there. But Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died, and she was left with her two sons. These two sons took Moabite wives. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other, Ruth. They lived there about 10 years. And both, Mahlon and Chilion, died, so that the woman was left without her two sons and her husband. You may be seated. The New Hebrides. Do you guys know where the New Hebrides is? It's a group of islands east of Australia. And I was thinking about the providence of God, the book of Ruth, and I think about one of my favorite missionaries, John G. Patton, and how he went to preach the gospel in those Pacific islands called New Hebrides. If you ask people how the gospel came to the New Hebrides, those who know missions, church history, you say, John Patton. He was the missionary to the New Hebrides. And yes, that's how the gospel came and flourished and penetrated the area. But few people know the process, the painful process for the gospel to take root in the area. So, John Piper, in his book about John Patton, he writes, "To the best of our knowledge, the New Hebrides had no Christian influence before John Williams and James Harris from the London Missionary Society landed in 1839. Both of these missionaries were killed and eaten by cannibals on the island of Eromonga on November 20th of that year, only minutes after going ashore. 48 years later, John Patton wrote, "Thus were the New Hebrides baptized with the blood of the martyrs, and Christ thereby told the whole Christian world that He had claimed these islands as His own." Patton and his pregnant wife, Mary, they sailed for the New Hebrides via Australia on April 16, 1858. It was at the age of 33. They reached their appointed island of Tanna on November 5, 1858. A long trip, sailing. The baby was born February 12, 1859. Patton describes our island exile thrilled with joy when the baby was born. But the greatest of the sorrows was treading hard upon the heels of that great joy. Mary, his wife, probably had malaria, bad fever, convulsion, shivering. She got pneumonia, diarrhea with delirium for 2 weeks. And suddenly the clouds become darker and darker over John Patton's life. So he writes, "Then in a moment, altogether unexpectedly, she died on March 3rd. To crown my sorrows and complete my lowliness, the dear baby boy, whom we had named after her father, Peter Robert Robson, was taken from me after 1 week's sickness on the 20th of March. Let those who have ever passed through any similar darkness as of midnight feel for me. As for all others, you would be more than vain to try to paint my sorrows." And he dug with his own hands right by his house the place to bury his wife and his baby boy. Patton goes on, "I felt her loss beyond all conception or description. In that dark land, it was very difficult to be resigned, left alone and in sorrowful circumstances.
I think you have a hard time, brothers and sisters. Look at that.
But feeling immovably assured that my God and Father was too wise and too loving to err in anything that He does or permits, I looked up to the Lord for help and struggled in His work. I do not pretend to see through the mystery of such visitations, wherein God calls away the young, the promising, and those sorely needed for His service here. But this I do know and feel, that in the light of such dispensations, it becomes us all to love and serve our blessed Jesus, so that we may be ready at His call for death and eternity. Listen to His words, because it sounds just like from a Puritan work. But feeling immovably assured that my God and Father was too wise and too loving to err in anything that He does or permits. That's the doctrine of providence. And that's what holds our souls and our lives when the frowning providence of God come upon our lives. Very similar to how Obadiah Sedgwick, one Puritan, he described the doctrine of providence. Divine providence is an external action of God whereby He conserves and governs what? All things. Not some things wisely and some things not so wisely. All things wisely, holily, justly, and powerfully to the admiration of His own glory. The doctrine of providence. We talk about the power of God, that God is almighty and He is almighty. The omnipotence, He's omnipotent. He has all power, God. But the doctrine of providence is very important. Because when you talk about the sovereignty of God, we are talking about His predetermined plans, the plans in eternity past. When you talk about providence, it's actually His working out of His sovereignty. It's how God works His providence in day to day. Divine providence is the upholding, guiding, and stirring of all things in order to bring about His predetermined plans into fulfillment. So everything that takes place in the world is not by chance. It's not because of luck. It's not fate. It's because there is a God who is all-powerful, all-wise, all-loving, and all-righteous. And He's governing all things. The sickness and the health, the riches and the poverty, the victory and the losses, life and death, joy and sorrow, they're all under the work of God's upholding and steering of the world. And you better believe this, and you better take this to heart, because you will suffer. And when you suffer, you better have this as your pillow. And that's what we're going to see here in the book of Ruth, how God's providence, many times, is not the way we like. We love talk about God's providence when we are being, receiving something good, right? Then there's providence. When God is giving us something good, then there's providence. But we forget that God's providence is also the pain when He's emptying us of worldly joys. That's part of His providence also. And that's what we're going to see here in Ruth, the frowning or the dark providence of God. Here's the outline. We're going to continue what we began last Lord's Day, looking at the tragedies surrounding this family from Bethlehem. So let's move, and I'm going to move quickly here, but I just want to remind you that these first five verses are crucial for the whole story, okay? That's why I'm taking my time and slowing down, and because that's the seed from which the story is going to go to develop. So we will not understand the rest of the story if you don't grasp the first five verses. That will make no sense. And these opening verses, these five verses, covers a time of about 10 years. 10 painful years. And in a matter of a few words, the dark clouds of a violent providence decimates the life of a woman, Naomi. Very quickly, the ulcer, the shooting, boom, 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 boom. And the last thing we see is this woman, Naomi, as good as dead, decimated by a violent providence of God upon her life. Once I heard someone saying this first five verses of Ruth is just like Saving Private Ryan. Do you know that movie?
If you can hold on for do you remember the beginning of the movie? How violent it is? How bloody it is? If you can endure the beginning, you can continue on with the story. And similar to the book of Ruth, you have this violent, gruesome picture here, and then the story develops. So let's move quickly, because we saw verses 1 and 2 already, but I want to just refresh your minds. The first tragedy, in the days when the judges were judging, and God is in charge of kings and presidents. God's in charge of those in authority. So under His providence, it doesn't matter if it's disciplinary, if He's disciplining someone, punishing, God is in charge of government. No king, no president, and no judges were raised apart from God's sovereign control of things. And that's what we see. That's the first tragedy. It's the Ruth, Naomi, they're living the days of the judges. A day of apostasy, evil day, people forsaking the Lord. And you can see that just by looking at the last verse of Judges. You can just look there, verse 25. That's the last verse of Judges before you come to Ruth. In those days there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And then there is this spiritual famine. People forsaking the law of the Lord, instruction of the Lord, consequently leads to the natural famine. So it says in verse 1, in the days when the judges were judging, there was a famine in the land. And the Lord is fulfilling His promises here. That was His promise. If you disobey My commandments, if you walk away from being faithful, I will curse you. And I will curse the land. The land that's supposed to be a land flowing with milk and honey will actually be a land with no milk and no honey. So God is fulfilling His promises. So verse 1 opens with a tragic scene, a time of spiritual and physical famine. The lack of spiritual food is demonstrated in the lack of natural food. And now the camera is zooming in this family. Look at verse 2. Now we get to know this family. It's just not any family. They have names. So it's during these tragic days of the judges that one man, Elimelech, my God is king, he meets his wife, Naomi, pleasant, Naomi. And they fall in love in Judah, in Bethlehem. And they marry each other, and they have kids. And they end up doing something that they should never have done. They go out of the promised land. They forsake the land of promise and move to enemy territory. They move to Moab. They abandoned the land where God's unique presence was dwelling, where the sacrifices were performed, where the law was to be obeyed, and wherein the Lord had carefully placed them. Elimelech's actions resemble the actions of Israel. He's doing what's good in his own eyes. Elimelech and Naomi, they resemble Israel, doing what's good in their own eyes. Spurgeon said, better poverty with the people of God than plenty outside the covenant land. And verse 2 tells us that what was supposed to be a sojourn actually becomes more permanent, and they remain there. So we can just picture now this family. They are in Moab. It's enemy's territory. And you can think about Naomi in a strange land, trying to make new friends, maybe try to adapt to the new culture, when suddenly a new disaster comes upon her. And you read in verse 3, but Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died. You think about the first three tragedies, the days of the judges, famine, moving to a different land. It's not that personal. But now things are getting more and more personal in her life. It's as if these dark clouds are just getting darker and darker. And then we are told that Elimelech died. And note that, look at how the narrator describes. It's just a cold and straightforward account. No details of the circumstances of the death, how he died. Doesn't tell us about the grieving process that Naomi is going through. Just simple facts. He died. And Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died. And the Hebrew structure here is very interesting. I don't know what version you have of the Bible. The ESV says, Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, or Naomi's husband. That's a very unique way of structuring. It's very rare in ancient literature to find a man named in terms of his relationship to a woman. Okay? So that's very unique. And there's a reason why. Because Naomi now is taking the spotlight. And there's a change. And it's important for you to see the changes. Because look at verses 1 and 2. Says, he and his wife and his two sons. And then verse 2, the name of Elimelech was, and his wife and his two sons. You see the masculine possessive here. His two sons. His wife. And things now start to change. Look at verse 3. It's her husband. It's her two sons. Why? He's out of the picture. Now the spotlight. And that's what the narrator wants us to see. The spotlight is on Naomi now. Elimelech died. Here is the exodus. Not from Moab to Bethlehem, but from life to death. He died in disobedience. He died outside the promised land. What a miserable way of dying. Being buried now in Moab. What a shame. A famine shattered the solidarity between the man and the land. Now death destroys the harmony between man and woman. And now Naomi must raise her two sons in Moab, a strange land, enemy's land. But she has the choice. She has the option to return. That's very important to think about. She can return now, because she will return later. So she can return now. But instead of returning, she chooses to remain there. One scholar says, now after Elimelech's death, the remnant of the family had a decision to make. They could repent and go back home to their own land and their own God, or they could stay where they were in exile. Tellingly, their choice was to stay. They still rated their prospects more highly in Moab than in Judah. They felt more at home in the land of compromise than in the land of promise. So I don't think that Naomi was a saint, that she was holy, perfect. No, she had the opportunity to go back, get the boys and say, we are getting out of here. And we know that she had the choice because in verse 21, Naomi acknowledged her own sin in remaining and in going there. Don't you think that Naomi had no participation on that? She is probably the one influencing Elimelech to get out of there. Because look at verse 21, chapter 1. Do not call me Naomi, call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. She doesn't say, Elimelech took us full out of here, and now I'm returning empty. You see? She's not blaming Elimelech. She doesn't say, we went full. I'm responsible for the sinful decisions also. But there is hope. Look at how the text ends. She was left with her two sons. Her two sons. So there is hope for Naomi. She doesn't have one, but she has two sons. And that's very precious. Widows always drew great comfort from the future potential of their children. So she has sons to take care of her. She has sons that will have grandchildren who will continue the line of her husband's name. So there is great hope. But suddenly we come to verse 4. And something strange happens. Look at that. These two sons took Moabite wives. The name of the one was Orpah and the name of the other Ruth. They lived there about 10 years. Naomi and her two sons become more and more comfortable in Moab. And they are so comfortable that they feel like there is no problem in compromising the faith and marrying a Moabite. Honestly, it would not be that hard to walk a journey back, maybe 3 days, 4 days, to find a godly woman, right? But they are so comfortable in Moab, who cares? We are part of this culture. We are part of this land here. And there is questions. Is it okay? Was it okay for them to marry the Moabite women? Was it fine? And that's interesting because as you read or as you listen to other preachers, as you read other commentators, they're going to say, oh, we are not sure. We are not sure if it was okay or not. And I disagree. I think that the scriptures are very clear that they were not supposed to marry Moabite. Here, in Deuteronomy chapter 7, listen to this. When the Lord, your God, brings you into the land that you are entering to take possession of it,
and clears away many nations before you, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, seven nations more numerous and mightier than you. And when the Lord your God gives them over to you and you defeat them, then you must devote them to complete destruction. You shall not make no covenant with them and show no mercy to them. You shall not intermarry with them, giving your daughters to their sons or taking their daughters for your sons. For, here's the reason, for they would turn away your sons from following me to serve other gods.
And I know what you're thinking. But he's not saying Moabites. He's not. And I believe that this list here is not exhaustive. It's an exemplary list. And that's what we find over and over through all the scriptures. It's not an exhaustive list. It's an exemplary list. And you have seven. Why? Complete. Like the seven churches, the seven nations. They represent all the pagan nations that you should never intermarry with. And I say, I'm not convinced about that. All right, so let's keep going to Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 23, verses 2 through 4. Look at that.
No one born of a forbidden union may enter the assembly of the Lord, even to the tenth generation. None of his descendants may enter the assembly of the Lord. No Ammonite or Moabite may enter the assembly of the Lord. Why? They will not. He goes on. Even to the tenth generation, none of them may enter the assembly of the Lord forever, because they did not meet you with the bread and with the water on the way when you came out of Egypt. Verse 2, look at that. Forbidden union connects you, Moabites. You can go to Ezra, and I'm going to give you one more. Ezra chapter 9, 1 through 3, and now Nehemiah 13. Look at Nehemiah. He understands the law, Deuteronomy. He understands that. In those days, I saw the Jews who had married women of Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. I saw Jews marry Moabite women. And half of their children spoke the language of Ashdod. And they could not speak the language of Judah, but only the language of each people. And I confronted them and cursed them and beat some of them and pulled out their hair. They're marrying Moabite women. And I made them take an oath in the name of God, saying, you shall not give your daughters and their sons, or take their daughters for your sons for yourselves, or for yourselves. I don't know. When people come and say, hey, we don't know if it was okay or not. Come on. It's very clear that it was not okay to marry Moabite women. It's very clear. John Wilch, in his commentary, he says, ever since their patriarch, the Israelites, at least in principle, if often not in practice, supported the custom of endogamy, that is, marrying within their own people in order to preserve their faith in God and His gracious covenant. Since the conquest of Canaan under Joshua, the practice of endogamy was also meant to keep the Israelites' land inheritance, because no stigma was attached to an exogamous marriage to a convert. That is, marrying a non-Israelite who worshipped Israel's God and accepted His covenant. The practice of endogamy was based primarily on religious and not on ethnicity. Are you listening? Why could they not marry other people? Not because of a different ethnicity. Not because of a different race. It was because of a different worship, a different religion. That was the rule. You will not marry people outside the covenant. Why? Because they will turn your hearts away from the Lord. And the same principle applies to us under the new covenant. Paul is very clear to Christians. Do not associate yourselves with those outside the covenant. So for those who are single, thinking about marrying, don't ever think it's okay for a missionary dating. Right? Oh, I'm going to bring that person to the Lord. No. You actually have your heart drawn to their gods. That's what the New Testament says. And some people will say, oh, but you see, the narrator here, the author, doesn't condemn them. Exactly. Just like in the book of Esther. It's very simple. Historical narratives often expect the readers themselves to recognize the sin. It's a historical narrative, and we must judge their actions by the biblical understanding that we have. That's why when you go to the book of Esther, the author doesn't need to say, man, that was pretty immoral of Esther going to the pagan king's chambers. He doesn't need to say that. Why? Because anyone with any sort of biblical understanding will say, oh, wait a minute, that's sin. Right? And the same thing here. He doesn't need to say that was wrong for them to leave the promised land. He doesn't need to say that was wrong for them to marry Moabite wives. It's clear there. So they took Moabite wives. The name of the one was Orpah. The name of the other Ruth. And they lived there about 10 years. So probably Naomi welcomes these marriages as a sweet medicine for her bitter soul. Why? Because now there is the prospect of continuing the line of Elimelech. So for her, there is great joy. There is the prospect of children. Joy has been restored with the anticipation of babies and the continuation of Elimelech's line. So we can see Naomi rejoicing with her two boys now married and having the prospect of children. Oh, sweet medicine for her bitter soul. Suddenly, we come to verse 5. And when we think that things could not get worse and the clouds could not get darker, look at verse 5. We are informed that not only one, but both of her sons died. Naomi has been devastated by a deadly storm. No husbands, no sons to take care of her. And when you think that things cannot get darker, hold on. Things can always get darker. Okay? Brothers and sisters, when you think that you came to the end of the rope, and you cannot suffer anymore, you can always suffer more. Okay? It can always get darker. Here's this woman. Look at Job. And Naomi pictures the nation of Israel. Right? Elimelech and Naomi, they symbolize Israel in doing what was good in their own eyes. And Naomi, like Israel, now is a widow in desperate need of God's mercy and loving kindness to provide for her. Just like Israel. Israel needs a faithful husband. Naomi also needs a husband or someone to take care of her. And we need to understand the situation of widows, because a lot of times living in America, it's easy to think about government support, right? Or some other types of support for widows. Let me remind you, back in the day, in the ancient Near East, there was no such thing as government support for the widows. Was your husband who supported you? If he died, the sons, grandsons, if not, you're lost. One scholar, he writes, the hazards of widowhood in antiquity were great. After her husband's death, normally a widow had to rely on her sons for support. If she had none, she might have to sell herself into slavery, resort to prostitution, and you can see in Amos 7:17, that's what the Lord promises, some women would lose their husbands, would become widows and end up in prostitution, or die. It's in part against this kind of harshness that the Redeemer kinsman legislation exists. Yahweh, the Lord, however, was concerned for the widows and the poor and decreed instructions for their preservation. So the laws for widows in the Old Testament shows the Lord's concern for widows in a society when, if you're a widow, too bad. You got to do something. So Naomi, because of her age and time spent in Moab, is truly hopeless of finding a husband or a relative to take care of her in Judah. Naomi is an old widow without children. One scholar says the worst fate that an Israelite woman might experience. And then look at verse 5. The last drop of suffering from this storm comes with the fact that she was left without her two sons and her husband, and no grandchildren. The sons died in infertility. They did not leave her any grandson to continue the family line. So here's the great irony. Moab, the place to which the family sought grain seed and life, became the setting, the stage of death and lack of human seed. The family that sought refuge from famine was actually decimated by death. The great irony. seeking food, seeking life outside. And actually what happens? They all die, decimated by death. And what began, remember verse 1, what began as a threat because of the lack of grain seed now turns to an even greater threat, for there is no human seed to continue the line of this family from Bethlehem. So Lawson, he writes, Lawson Jr., he says, the family of Elimelech teeters on annihilation. In ancient Israel, the loss of a family from existence was a great tragedy. When a family died out physically, it ceased to exist metaphysically. That robbed Israel of one of her most prized possessions, namely clan and tribal solidarity. And that's why it's crucial to see how the author describes Naomi now. So he says, the woman was left without her two sons and her husband. That's the second time he used the word was left. He used in verse 3, now he's using again. Tsar seems to be used almost exclusively to indicate the static action of surviving after an elimination process. That's the same word, the root of this word is for remnant. Remember the remnant in Israel? That's the same root word here. It often refers to those who have survived the wrath and judgment of God. The same word used for Noah. And Noah was left with his family. And everybody else died. So if you know Hebrew, if you know the scriptures, that might be sounding like a new creation. Is there the hope of a new creation just like with Noah here? And look at the way that the author describes Naomi. It's artistically brilliant, I think. The woman. Naomi is a paradox. A person who survived. She was left. She was a remnant. And at the same time, she's as good as dead. The woman. She has no name anymore. Her character, the name. So she's not even treated as Naomi. She's treated as the woman. Why? Because it's as if she died. As if she has no life. The woman creates strong emotions on those who are reading or listening to this story. After this devastation, Naomi is nameless. All her identity has been stripped away from her. And if you can picture that as if it was a movie scene, you can picture this woman in the Middle East, probably hot weather, maybe on her knees, with a shovel in her hands, kneeling between three graveyards, her husband and her two sons. Probably even unable to cry anymore. So devastated by what happened to her. Maybe the things going through her mind, the famine, the days of the judges, the moving to Moab, losing her beloved husband, losing her two boys, no one to continue the family line, no one to provide for her. Frederick Bush, he writes, from wife to widow, from mother to no mother, this female is stripped of all identity, the security of husband and children, which a male-dominated culture afford its women, is hers no longer. The definition of worth by which it values the female applies to her no more. The blessings of old age, which it gives through progeny, are there no longer. A stranger in a foreign land, this woman is a victim of death and a victim of life. And by now, the narrator captures the audience, and the audience is listening and just wondering, what's going on here? What's happening to this woman? Who caused that to this woman? Who brought these calamities upon her? Was it bad luck? Fate? Chance? Who did that to this woman? Who brought this devastation towards her life? Look at how she answers. Look at verse 20, chapter 1. The Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. The Lord, the Almighty. She knows. She knows that the God who gives life is the God who takes life away. Exodus chapter 4. Then the Lord said to Moses, who has made men's mouth? Who makes him mute, or deaf, or seeing, or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? She knows. He who gives seed is the same one who withholds seed. There is no cosmic tug of war between the Lord and Satan. God is ultimately in control of all things. And then the question, why did God do this to this woman? Why did God decimate her life? She's as good as dead now. Might as well just kill this woman. Right? Finish the job. Put her to death. Why so much suffering? And then we think about this, biblically speaking. Why so much suffering? And there are things that the Lord revealed to us. Why we suffer. Sometimes we suffer because of sin that we committed and the Lord is disciplining us. The Bible is very clear that the Lord disciplines those whom He loves. So sometimes the pain that we are suffering, the suffering that we are receiving is because of sin. Other times the suffering is in order for us not to sin. Paul says, it was given to me a thorn in my flesh. Why? So I may not sin. You see, sometimes suffering is because of sin, and sometimes suffering is in order for you not to sin. Sometimes suffering is in order for you to comfort others, to prepare you for a greater glory. So do you see, sometimes people say, oh, we cannot say why this person is suffering. I disagree with that. We can say why, because God has given us. He has given us revelation why people suffer. Why is this couple suffering with the Lord, this three-year-old beautiful baby girl? Some people say, don't dare to say why. And we can say why. We know if they're Christians that God is actually working in them a greater glory. And that God is using that suffering in order for them to comfort others. So there is the revealed will of God. But also there is the secret will of God. And that we don't dare to say why that person is suffering. Because we don't know. We might know later or maybe we will never know. With Ruth and Naomi, we know. Part, there was disobedience. And part, there is the secret will of Yahweh that she has no idea what's going on. But as the book develops, we will understand why all this suffering and pain. So as we move on with the book, we see that the dark clouds of providence, the frowning providence of God, becomes the smiling providence of God. So the story begins with the dark days of the judges. And the story will end with the bright King David. The story begins with an Ephrathite of Bethlehem forsaking the kingship of God, Elimelech. And the story ends with an Ephrathite of Bethlehem who will exercise his kingship in the fear of God, David. In verse 5, the woman was left with her two, and the Hebrew there is very unique. Usually in Hebrew, we talk about sons, older sons, with the word ben. Benin, sons. But here used the Yeladea, the little boys. Why? Because the story will end with Naomi holding what? The Yelad, the little boy. So in this dark providence, she loses her two little boys. But when the dark clouds go away and the sun starts shining, she's holding her little boy in her chest. The story begins with a dark period of 10 years of infertility and barrenness. And the story ends with a genealogy. And if you go to the genealogy and you count the names in the genealogy, there are 10 names. Why? The 10 years of barrenness, infertility, is now fulfilled with 10 names leading to David. So that's God's process. He empties us. He empties us in order to fulfill. So all this pain and suffering. Think about this. All this pain and suffering. Picture this woman. Now on her knees, she has no name. Standing there between the three graves of her husband and her two sons. No one to take care. As good as dead. Might as well just be killed. Actually, this woman who is as good as dead will return to Bethlehem with one of her daughters-in-law. And from that line will come whom? Jesus Christ. So you think about the dark, devastating, frowning providence of God in the days of the judges with Naomi suffering was actually preparing the coming of no one else but Jesus Christ. That's mind-boggling. She never saw that and she had no idea that as she was going through all those sufferings, the Lord was actually bringing about the coming of Jesus. We must always bow before the goodness of God. When we cannot see His hand working, we must always trust His heart. Right? When we don't see what He's doing, we must always trust His heart. William Cooper, that beautiful hymn, God moves in mysterious ways. He says, the clouds ye so much dread are big with mercy and shall break in blessings on your head. Judge not the Lord by feeble sense, but trust Him for His grace. Behind a frowning providence, He hides a smiling face. And that's all we see here. And remember, I start this story with John Patton. All his sufferings. All his sufferings. And one thing that's important to remember is that his wife, Mary, never got to see the fruit of that suffering. So don't think that every time that God is bringing a painful providence, in the end you're going to be able to look and say, wow, that was beautiful. Maybe we will die in the process. Okay? So don't you ever think that every time God has to work this thing that you must see in the end and say, wow, that was beautiful. Sometimes the Lord will take you and you will not see anything. And He will actually use your death, your sickness, in a way to glorify His name, and you will never know. Mary Patton never saw what happened to the island that she went and died. But listen to John Patton's words. Oftentimes, while passing through the perils and defeats of my first 4 years in the mission field in Tana, I wondered why God permitted such things. But on looking back now, I already clearly perceive that the Lord was thereby preparing me for doing and providing me materials wherewith to accomplish the best work of all my life, namely, the kindling of the heart of the Australian Presbyterianism with a living affection for these islanders of their own southern seas. And in being the instrument under God of sending out missionary after missionary to the New Hebrides to claim another island and still another for Jesus, that work and all that may spring from it in time and eternity never could have been accomplished by me but for first the sufferings. Without those sufferings, I could never have accomplished what the Lord accomplished in that place. For first the sufferings and then the story of my Tana enterprise. In 1887, John Patton records the triumphs of the gospel. How those dark clouds and painful storms actually brought a beautiful and glorious crop. He says, recall what the gospel has done for near kindred of the same aborigines. On our own Aneteum, 3,500 cannibals have been led to renounce their heathenism. In Fiji, 79,000 cannibals have been brought under the influence of the gospel. And 13,000 members of the churches are professing to live and work for Jesus. In Samoa, 34,000 cannibals have professed Christianity. And in 19 years, its college has sent forth 206 native teachers and evangelists. On our new Hebrides, more than 12,000 cannibals have been brought to sit at the feet of Christ. Though I mean not to say that they are all model Christians. And 133 of the natives have been trained and sent forth as teachers and preachers of the gospel. Imagine his first days there, the suffering. Imagine the family of the first two missionaries who died as soon as they stepped there and they were murdered and eaten by cannibals. And by their death, the Lord was using to stir up the heart of John Patton, his wife Mary. And then they go. And then all the sufferings, bearing his wife, his baby boy with his own hands by his house, almost died over and over and over again. You see, he had no idea what the Lord was doing through all that suffering, all that dark providence. And that leads me to, lastly, we always must interpret our dark providence in light of the darkest providence of all. Let me ask you, don't look there. Is there any darker providence than the one that Jesus Christ went through? Can there be any greater suffering than what Jesus went through, the Holy One? Can anybody go through a darker and heavier providence than what Jesus went through in His death and resurrection? No. No one dared to say that. You better not to say that someone will suffer more than what Christ suffered. And yet, in the greatest
and darkest providence of all, the Lord was working something beautiful there. He was working life. So if God was working life and blessings through the darkest, most painful providence in the history of mankind, who are you to think, with your little dark providence compared to Jesus, that God is now working something beautiful in your life? Right? The hermeneutics of our suffering is the cross of Jesus. Every dark providence comes from the loving hands of God and has a beautiful design. If the darkest and most painful providence, the death of Jesus, had glorious purposes and a beautiful design, so we may take comfort that ours will bring also glory to God. We're going to sing a hymn right now, When Trials Come. It's a beautiful hymn. And makes sense in light of what we just heard here. The hymn says, when trials come, no longer fear. For in the pain, our God draws near to fire faith worth more than gold. And there, His faithfulness is told. That's the book of Ruth. That's the story of the cross. And that must be our lives. Father, we thank You. We thank You that we have an all-wise, all-powerful, all-righteous, all-holy, all-loving God who reigns the earth with wisdom. Lord, we take great comfort that nothing happens outside Your almighty control and providence of everything, Lord. Lord, give us eyes to see within the mystery that behind the frowning providence, there is a smiling face, and You're working all things for Your glory. Help us to rejoice in You. Help us to rejoice in our sufferings. Help us to rejoice in the dark and frowning clouds of providence. Help us to stop grumbling and complaining and murmuring, and instead delight that we have a great God. In Jesus' name, amen.